Yeah, thanks to the organisers for putting this very nice workshop together. I can tell that it's a nice workshop because almost everything I was going to say has already been said by somebody else, which should mean this will be a very relaxing talk. Might even get us back on schedule.
It can't be relaxing because everybody's now afraid that the scenario they work on is part of the boringness.
Yeah, well, you'll find out how to check that. So. All right, so the basic problem I want to talk about is one quite closely related to what Marina spoke about yesterday. So she was trying to sort causal scenarios which were represented using these MDAGs into equivalence classes, observational equivalence classes. What I'm talking about is actually technically a subproblem of that, which is just which of those are interesting in the sense that they have equality constraints, inequality constraints, and which ones of them are boring in the sense that the only constraints on the correlations are equality constraints, such as conditional independences. All right, so let me just kind of dive in and give an example of a scenario that counts as interesting, which is one you've all seen before, the Bell scenario. Okay, so we've got these outcomes A and B and settings X and Y. And I'm going to use a little bit of notation, which is I'm going to use this curly C to represent probability distributions over the observed nodes, which when I draw a DAG, observed nodes are triangles and unobserved nodes or latent variables are circles. So curly C means distributions over the observed nodes that arise as marginals of probability distributions over all of the nodes that are Markov for this DAG. Okay. So in the particular case of this Bell scenario, this just means the usual classical correlations for this Bell scenario. Right, these are the, this is like the usual Bell locality condition that Alice's outcome only depends on her setting in the hidden variable, Bob's outcome only depends on his setting, his hidden variable. So these are the usual like Bell local correlations for this scenario. And then I'll use curly I to represent distributions over the observed nodes that satisfy the conditional independences that you would expect amongst the observed nodes, namely the ones that you get from deseparation. So in the case of the Bell scenario, a generating set of independences is that X should be independent of Y, A should be independent of Y given X, and B should be independent of X given Y. Okay, so this is basically the usual no signaling probabilities in the Bell scenario. Kind of the only slight wrinkle is that normally people talk about A, B given X, Y, so they don't really care about what the distribution over the settings is. Here we're kind of treating the settings on an equal footing to everything else. We just have a distribution over A, B, X, and Y. And this particular scenario requires that the settings X and Y are independent. Okay, so then having set up all this notation, like Bell's really important result that there's something interesting going on in this scenario can just be summarized as saying that C is not equal to I. Okay, because there are constraints on C, namely the Bell inequalities, that are not constraints on I. Okay, and this scenario kind of already has the seeds of why you should care about which scenarios are interesting and which ones aren't. The reason it was interesting for Bell, of course, was that if instead of a local hidden variable here, you have a quantum state, then you can get distributions that violate the Bell inequalities. So this was something Rob talked about in his talk, that when you see a violation of the Bell inequality, you can kind of interpret that as a witness that you've got something non-classical going on at this source here. So that's the kind of quantum foundations reason why it's useful to know that this is interesting. And if you don't care about quantum theory, you just want to do classical causal inference, it still kind of matters that this scenario is interesting, because it means that if you want to check whether some data you've got can be explained using this scenario, you shouldn't only check the conditional independences, you should also check these other constraints on C, which are the Bell inequalities. Okay, so from the classical point of view, interesting scenarios are just ones where if you want to verify that they can explain your data, you need to do more than just look at conditional independences. And conversely, boring scenarios are ones where you only have to check the conditional independences. Okay, everyone happy so far? Cool. So how can we check that a scenario is interesting? The first thing it's worth doing is just looking at the deseparation relations in your scenario and asking, can they also be achieved in a scenario that doesn't have any latent variables? The reason to do this is that if they can't, then that immediately tells you that your scenario is interesting. And that's thanks to this very nice result by Robin Evans that's already been mentioned. So this result says that any boring scenario is observationally equivalent to a latent-free scenario. Okay, and if your deseparation relations don't match any latent-free scenario, then they can't possibly be equivalent to any latent-free scenario. And so by Evans' result, you immediately conclude that your scenario is interesting. Okay, so this actually already takes care of lots of scenarios. In particular, it already takes care of the Bell scenario. You can just check that those conditional independences you get in the Bell scenario can't arise in any latent-free scenario. And so you can immediately conclude that this is an interesting scenario. Okay, so Bell's theorem is just a special case of this result. That's maybe a bit less impressive than it sounds, because the proof of this result does actually appeal to Bell inequalities, but it's nice that it kind of gets subsumed into this. Okay, so that's the first thing you should do, just check your deseparation relations, whether they can arise in a latent-free scenario. If they can, then I'm just going to call this other graph, latent-free graph, that has the same deseparation relations, H. So let's see an example of that. So this is, yeah?
Sorry. So if you go to the previous slide, is there a limit on the number of nodes you need to check?
Pardon?
So you're saying if there exists no graph, right?
Uh-huh.
Is there no upper bound on the number of nodes you need to test for this?
Yes, because we're only looking for latent-free DAGs, you're just looking at all of the DAGs on your observed nodes. Okay, so like in the Bell scenario, you just have those four observed nodes, the two settings and the two outcomes. So you just need to check all of the DAGs just on those four nodes.
Same vertex set. Just check DAGs on the same vertex set.
Yeah.
Okay, I see. Okay, otherwise, it would be late. I see.
Matt?
Yeah?
Do you think there's any more smart way to check if a set of these separation relations is achievable in some latent free than just checking all of the latent free and seeing their disappearance? Because this is kind of what I did. I checked all.
I think you should just be able to apply like IC star or something to your conditional independences.
I think you can run the PC algorithm on the deseparations.
No, I think not, because the PC algorithm only gives the correct output if they're consistent with the DAG.
But I mean, the point is, if they're not, then you can just see that they're not. Right?
Okay.
So I would have thought that was computationally quite cheap.
Yeah. Okay. So I think we're agreed that you basically run your favorite causal inference algorithm on the observed conditional dependencies, and then whatever it gives you, just check, does that really reproduce the correct independences? And if it does, then you're happy. Okay, so this hopefully can be done quite easily. And the interesting case is then when you find that actually there is a latent free DAG with the same conditional independences. So a simple example of that is the instrumental scenario that we've already seen a few times. So this scenario has no observed conditional independences. Okay, so in my notation, the set I is just the set of all probability distributions over these three variables. It's kind of totally unrestricted. And of course, there is a latent free DAG that can achieve that. For example, this one, right? This DAG also imposes no constraints on the distribution over these three variables. Okay, so at the level of deseparation relations, you can't tell the difference between these two scenarios. But we have seen that this scenario is actually interesting, so we need to do a bit more. But in fact, all we need to do at this point is to show that this scenario is not equivalent to this scenario. Right? Because if it was equivalent to this scenario, then this scenario is obviously boring because it doesn't have any latent free nodes. Right? This is just the converse of Evans' result. So Evans showed that if something is boring, then it's equivalent to latent free. The other way around is that if it's equivalent to latent free, then it's boring. Which is just kind of immediate. So if we can show that this is not equivalent to this, then we know that this must be interesting, right? Because then the set C for this must be different to the set C for this, even though the set I for this is equal to the set I for this. And over here, the set C is equal to the set I. Does that make sense? So if we want to show that this is interesting, we just need to find some difference to this scenario. And again, we can use something that we've already heard about, namely eseparation. So we can notice that in this scenario, X is eseparated from B upon deletion of A. Right? If I delete A, then I basically isolate X, and so X becomes deseparated from B in that new scenario. Okay. Whereas over here, if I delete A, then X is still connected to B by this arrow here. Okay, so this one has an eseparation relation, this one doesn't. For example, this inequality that we heard about yesterday would apply in this scenario, and it wouldn't apply in this scenario. Okay, and they actually show in an appendix to this paper that whenever a eseparation relation doesn't hold, you can violate the inequality that you would have gotten had the eseparation, if the eseparation did hold. Okay, so just from the fact that these two things have different eseparation relations, they have to be different, and therefore this one is interesting. So that's kind of two things you can do. You can check the deseparation relations, see if they look interesting. If that fails, check the eseparation relations, see if those look interesting. But it can be that both of those fail. So this is another example of a scenario where there are no observed conditional independences, which means it's equivalent to this boring situation where you can achieve, it means the those same conditional independences, namely none, can also be achieved in this boring scenario.
Matt?
Yeah?
I'm sorry, there is a question in the Zoom chat.
Okay.
Just reminding people online to ask on Slack and not in the Zoom chat, but I'm going to read it anyway. So Robin Evans said, we do have an oracle though, right? Just looking at G, but I don't know what it means.
Robin, you can also just speak up and ask. We can hear you.
Sorry, I was trying to send that to someone else. It wasn't a question.
Okay, cool. All right, so we can't tell the difference between these two by looking at D separation, and we can't tell the difference by looking at E separation either, because there are no E separation relations amongst the observed nodes in this scenario. So we have to try something else here. And there's a few different things you could try, but one that seems to be very effective is to use a TC Fraser's algorithm that will just allow you to find out which supports are feasible in this scenario and which supports are feasible in this scenario. See, if you find a support that's feasible in this scenario that isn't feasible, sorry, if you find a support that's feasible in this scenario that's not feasible in this scenario, then you can conclude that these are inequivalent and therefore this one on the left is interesting. Okay, and in this particular case, Fraser's algorithm will give you, amongst other things, an example we've already seen, which is that a distribution on these three variables that's supported exactly on 0, 0, 0, and 1, 1, 1 is certainly feasible over here, because everything is feasible over here, but it's not feasible over here. Okay, so this support is enough to conclude that this scenario is interesting. All right, so that's kind of a bit of a quick tour over the ways that you can show that something's interesting. Maybe one more thing I'll mention that's the first thing that hasn't already been talked about is something called reduction. So sometimes you might have a scenario like this where maybe you can't see immediately whether this is interesting or not. But there's something quite suspicious, which is that this is the triangle scenario, except I've added this extra thing here. And what reduction allows you to do is to say, given that the triangle scenario is interesting, as we saw in the previous slide, I can also conclude that this scenario is interesting. And the way you basically do that is you take whatever it was you used to show that the triangle scenario was interesting. So that would be some distribution that's supported on 0, 0, 0, and 1, 1, 1 for A, B, C. And then you just make D take a fixed value. Okay, so that's certainly still not going to be achievable in this scenario, right? Because by making T take a fixed value, it's become totally useless, right? This D can't explain any correlations between A, B, and C if it always takes a fixed value. So if D takes a fixed value, then it's still going to be impossible to have this 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 1 distribution over A, B, C. And if D takes a fixed value, it's also not going to mess up any D separation relations that you have. So reduction basically allows us to solve some larger scenarios by realizing that some smaller part of it is already interesting. Okay, and this is kind of described in excruciating detail in an appendix of this paper. A lot of those reductions are already taken care of by this MDAG formalism. So I think if you strip out what's left after you go to MDAGs, then it should be something fairly manageable that just allows you to deal with examples like this. Okay, so that's a few ways to show that things are interesting. There are other things you can try, like entropic inequalities that we've already heard about. But let me now look at the other side, which is how to show that things are boring. So this is my favorite example of a boring scenario. It's kind of like a Bell scenario, except that Bob is just always doing a fixed measurement. Okay, he doesn't have a setting. So if you're familiar with Bell inequalities, you'll probably know that there aren't any Bell inequalities in this scenario. Okay, so this is a boring scenario. And just to kind of reiterate what I mean by saying that this is boring, I mean that everything you can achieve classically here, as long as you're satisfying the observed conditional independences, which is just here that X is independent of B. Okay, so any distribution that has X independent of B, which would be the curly I for this scenario, is also in curly C. Okay, so this is boring. And there's a way that we can kind of show this graphically. So what we do is we notice that when we started, the only parent of B was this hidden variable here. So without loss of generality, we could just assume that B was being determined by this hidden variable. Okay, and if B is being determined by this hidden variable, then since A also has this hidden variable, A already knows what B is. In which case, there's no harm in just adding an arrow from B to A, right? So this hasn't actually allowed us to do anything new, because A might have already known what B was anyway. So this arrow is not actually letting us do anything new. So we can do that. And then we could just decide we're going to get rid of this hidden variable. That's certainly not going to let us do anything new. So now we've got this scenario that we have argued does not allow us to do anything that we couldn't have done in the original scenario. But this scenario is clearly boring. It doesn't have any unobserved nodes. And the last thing you just have to check is that the conditional independences in this scenario are the same as in the scenario we started with, namely X is independent of B. Okay, so just to specify what I was doing in that example a bit more formally, there's kind of two things you're allowed to do. You're allowed to add an edge between nodes X and Y as long as the parents of X were a subset of the parents of Y. Okay, so we heard about this rule yesterday. And the parents of X have to have an unobserved node just so that any local randomness in X can be dealt with by moving that randomness into the unobserved parent. Okay, and again, the idea is that if the parents of X are a subset of the parents of Y, then and any local randomness at X has been determined by this unobserved parent, then Y already knows everything it needs to in order to determine X. And so there's no harm in adding this arrow from X to Y. And certainly, there's no harm in removing an edge that's not going to allow you to do anything new. So the kind of point of these rules is that if you can transform a DAG G to a DAG H under these rules, then classically, H can't do anything that G couldn't do. Okay, so the classical correlations for H are a subset of the classical correlations for G. Since the final step was just removing all unobserved nodes, H is certainly boring. So CH is equal to IH. And then you just do that last bit of checking that the conditional independences haven't changed, that IG is equal to IH. So then we've got that IG is equal to IH, which is equal to CH. So therefore, IG is a subset of CG. And since C is always a subset of I, we can conclude that G is boring. Okay. Does that make sense? It's a bit of a convoluted way of putting it, but basically we're just doing transformations that are just making the scenario weaker and weaker, and then we find that we get to something where you can do everything, and therefore the original scenario you must have been able to do everything as well. Okay, so in order to show that things are interesting, I gave you this whole like zoo of different techniques. For showing that things are boring, this seems to be all you need. Okay, so we don't know of any scenario that's boring that you can't show is boring using just this one technique, which is kind of interesting. All right, so one thing we've been doing lately is to just see if putting all these things together, we can solve the problem of interesting versus boring for all of the MDAGs with 4 observed nodes. Okay, so 3 observed nodes is solved. You saw that yesterday. There were just those 3 interesting scenarios, the triangle, the instrumental, and the Evans. For 4 observed nodes, it starts to get a bit more complicated. So there's a total of 2,809 MDAGs on 4 observed nodes. If you apply this condition that I just talked about for showing that something is boring, you remove about 2,000 of them as being boring, and you're left with 996 that might be interesting. Then you can use some of these reduction techniques to actually realize that most of these are reducible to just 87. So these are the kind of 87 critical ones that you need to check. E-separation takes care of quite a few of those, gets you down to 54. And then Fraser's algorithm does very well. It solves like 51 of these and leaves you with just 3 scenarios. Okay, we don't actually know whether this is the furthest you can get with Fraser's algorithm, because in order to apply the algorithm, you have to decide what cardinality of variables you're going to use. And you can check all of these scenarios with binary variables, and that takes care of most of them. And then you can push it a bit further by increasing the cardinality a little bit, like making some of them have cardinality 3. But at some point, it just gets computationally quite expensive. So it's possible that if you had a better computer, you would be able to do more of these with Fraser's algorithm. But certainly, if you just look at binary supports, then in these 3 scenarios, you don't see any difference. Okay, so the last thing I want to do is to just show you those 3 scenarios. So here's one of them. So just to emphasize, this only condition we have for showing that something is boring does not apply to this scenario. So we don't know that it's boring. And that whole zoo of techniques for showing that it's interesting, we haven't been able to apply to this scenario. For example, we've tried looking for entropic inequalities, but the Fourier-Motzkin problem just seems to be a little bit too hard. So we don't know that this is boring, and we don't know that this is interesting. And similarly for this scenario and for this scenario. Okay, so if anybody has a bright idea for solving these 3 scenarios, then maybe by the end of this workshop we will know the answer for all MDAGs with 4 observed nodes. And a bit more ambitiously, it would be very nice to actually just prove that whenever this graphical condition for boring does not apply, the scenario is interesting. right? That certainly seems to be the case in the overwhelming majority of small MDAGs, but that would be very nice if that was true, because then you wouldn't need to search through this whole zoo of techniques for showing that something is interesting. You would just check whether it's boring. And if the thing says it's not boring, then you would know that it was interesting. And actually, this recent result by Evans gives some hope that this is possible, because the way that the criteria for boring works is it shows that it's equivalent to something latent free. And what Evans has shown is that anything that's boring is equivalent to something latent free, right? So basically, if this condition is going to work in every case, then Evans's result had to hold. So it's kind of like promising that it actually does. All right, that's all I wanted to say. Thanks.
Any questions from Zoom?
I have two questions, actually.
Go ahead.
Hey, Matthew, thank you for the talk. You mentioned before that the Fourier-Moltke algorithm seemed a bit too hard. I wanted to ask you something a little bit technical, which is if you have tried considering things like acceleration theorems, like Imbert's acceleration theorems, to avoid redundancies when considering large inequalities on Fourier-Moltke. They seem to be computationally efficient. I don't know if you have tried them.
So my PhD student, Shashank Khanna, who's, I think, participating online, has been working hard on this, and he's tried the like Imbert's acceleration theorems. He's also just tried some heuristics for trying to eliminate the variables in a clever order. I think one thing he hasn't quite managed to do yet is combine those heuristics with the acceleration theorems. So there's maybe still some sliver of hope that if you really throw all the tricks that we have, it might just about be feasible. But so far, even using the acceleration theorems, it still seems to be too difficult.
Okay, and thank you. And my follow-up question is to prove that something is interesting, if I understood correctly, it's enough to prove that there is a quantum classical gap, for instance, right? Is correct?
That's enough.
That's enough, right?
Pardon?
That's enough, correct?
Yeah, but it's probably harder than that, right? Because basically to show that there's a quantum classical gap, you would need some kind of inequality, or
yes.
Presumably you would need some kind of inequality for the classical set.
Yes, of course.
And so basically at that point, you've already shown that it's interesting once you have that inequality. Trying to show that quantum theory can violate that inequality is just like, then extra work for yourself, I would have thought.
No, it's just so I could understand, because there's actually some work where if there is no direct causal effect from like some observable variable, so you have a network, so it's a particular case, of course, but if you have networks with no messages between the observable parts and only networks without inputs, there are some like generic techniques to find quantum no locality. So perhaps like for more elaborate cases, I don't know, it's called like token counting and color matching techniques, where you given some assumptions of the latent structure of the graph, perhaps, then there might be quantum advantages known, and they're not so obvious to see, like in CHSH violation terms. So it's just for perhaps for observational variables. Perhaps this is could be interesting to see the latent structure. That was just a comment, actually.
Yeah, I think it would definitely be worth checking that there aren't results like that that already help. But my suspicion would be that anything that those can show interesting can also be just shown using one of the techniques that we already have. So yeah, definitely, definitely okay. It's something worth checking.
This is thank you. A comment than a question, a little bit frivolous in a way. So when we write up results, I find it very difficult to communicate to the reader that the terms boring and interesting are technical jargon that shouldn't be interpreted in the ordinary language way. So I want to know whether you'd be on board with changing the terminology to semi-algebraic and algebraic, because the non-trivial constraints are semi, it describes the compatible distributions are a semi-algebraic set, they're all semi-algebraic sets, but the non-trivial constraints are semi-algebraic, whereas if it's just equality constraints, then the non-trivial constraints are algebraic. So I'm just curious whether you'd be on board with that, because I don't know if you found the same problem in writing up this sort of stuff.
I think this is like the most Rob question I've ever had in a talk.
I would say the exact opposite. You should go the Miguel Navasquez route and call them losers and winners.
It should be noted that the class you call boring is the one that the classical causal inference community has mostly focused on.
So I'm keep it simple rather than complicated.
I don't know. I haven't found many people who have some intuitive idea of interesting and boring that's in conflict with this technical definition. I think maybe the only slight wrinkle is that for someone from a quantum foundations point of view, for something to be really interesting, we do actually want a quantum classical gap. And with this definition of interesting, that's not necessarily the case.
Very nice states is about the same thing, right?
All right, there be a real question then, which is that in Salman Beghi's talk, it was noted that, for example, in the instrumental scenario, if you make the instrument continuous variable rather than discrete, the inequalities don't apply any longer. Have you given any thought to, I haven't, to how the classification changes if we move to continuous variables? Or some of the variables being continuous?
No.
The entropic techniques that you used in the original paper would still apply, right? But how much of the new techniques, which kind of resolve some of the new questions, are robust to making things continuous variable?
So, in terms of showing that something is interesting, if you have a discrete example that shows that it's interesting, I guess you could just declare that those are continuous variables that happen to only take those particular values, right? You could say, I'm studying the triangle scenario with discrete variables, but I'm just looking at the distribution where it's 0, 0, 0, and 1, 1, 1. I don't know if you would count that as cheating or something.
For something like the instrumental variables example, it won't work to do that, because if you make the treatment continuous, then you lose all the instrumental inequalities.
Well, in that scenario, I would just make the treatment, even though the treatment is nominally continuous, it would only take on a discrete set of values, and so
it wouldn't be able to transmit that to the outcome, though. So it would be like you had a noisy measurement of the real model. So anything that's apparent, you can't do that with, generally.
So Matt, are you saying that, suppose the instrument variable is X, I define a new discrete variable x prime as whether x is greater than or less than 0. It takes the value 1 if x is greater or equal to 0, and the value 0 if it's less. And now I look at the instrumental scenario for x prime rather than x. You're not saying that.
No.
Okay, what are you saying exactly?
I'm saying x is a real number, but it just happens to only ever take the values 0 or 1.
Okay. So then
I think the fact that nominally it could take other values does not actually allow it to do anything new if it never actually takes any of those other values.
It's not useful though, right? Because it doesn't just take those values; it will take all the other values.
But
as well.
But to show that it's interesting, I just need to give one example of a distribution that's not classically feasible.
Oh, yeah, I see. Okay.
But it sounds like you're saying that there's some caveat to the claim that the instrumental inequalities don't hold if the instrumental variable is continuous. That they still hold if I add extra assumptions about the distribution on that continuous variable. That's what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, it's just kind of a silly point, right? That.
Right.
If it's nominally continuous, but in fact only takes a discrete set, then morally you are back to the discrete case.
I take your point, and I'm left more confused about continuous. I have to think about it.
I mean, you might want to add some condition that rules out that kind of game and say that like it really does have to actually use the entire. Or it does actually have to use a continuous set of values. And then on the, so that's all on the interesting side. On the boring side, I mean, technically we were assuming discrete variables when we did the proofs, but I would very strongly guess that it would still work for continuous variables. And so anything that we say is boring, I'd be willing to bet is still boring even with continuous variables. But yeah, I think technically there might be something to prove there.
Any further questions?
Actually, yeah. Yes. Shawshank wants to make a comment, but I'm not sure it's about it.
Shashank, do you want to just speak up? I think this is in response to Pedro's question about accelerated brain muscle. Shashank, I'm assuming that by choosing not to speak up, you are happy to just leave the
topic. Right. Any other questions for Matt?
So, thanks so much.